What's your problem?
Right, just settle down now. Oh, excuse me.
So sorry.
What?
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 Welcome to the seventh episode of Zero Hour Strikes, the show that covers DC's 1994 crossover event, Zero Hour Crisis in Time, every issue, every tie-in, every Zero issue. I'm Siskoid.
I'm Bess.
And in this episode, we take a look at Shadow of the Bat number 31 and Robin number 10, so another Batman family episode. Thank God Batman still has fans.
Well, the last time we did a series, we hardly had any Batman.
It's true. That's true.
So this time we're
a lot of Batman.
We have a lot of Batman.
Shadow of the Bat was, when it started, the fourth monthly Batman book devoted to stories with limited serials, with distinct artists, though mostly written by Alan Grant. So it was a little like Legends of the Dark Knight, but taking place in the present instead of Batman's early career. Over time, it just became just another Batman book.
That's pretty much what happens with every book like that. You know, they start off with a certain theme, and then it just becomes another Batman.
Let's talk about this cover.
Yeah.
By Brian Stelfreeze first. It's very retro, even Golden Age.
Yeah.
And the type of layout and the poses, and it features a rather more rotund version of Alfred, bringing the dynamic duo Cake and Lemonade. There are stains and creases printed on. What do you think of this cover?
Well, I really enjoyed it, actually. It looks like something out of, you know, the Golden Age. If we didn't have the Zero Hour logo on there, and we didn't recognize the Tim Drake Robin.
He got like the split toes and the pants.
Yeah, and the little pockets on the arms and shoulders. Yeah. And evidently, Tim Drake. Other than that, it really looks like a vintage cover. So I really dug it.
Me too. I mean, especially since we're doing, you know, out of time.
Yeah.
Maybe this book is out of time. The cover is out of time.
That's what I figured. So I was like, ooh, and who's this fat guy on there? And I didn't recognize,
this Alfred?
Yeah, this Alfred. I didn't recognize him at all. So I was like, ooh, who's this guy?
On the cover, it says, in this issue, really like old fonts, the dynamic duo takes on the battling butler, which is actually an early Buster Keaton movie.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, that's kind of a fun one. So that's where the title probably comes from.
Battling Butler?
The Battling Butler, where he's like this rich guy, Buster Keaton, plays like this rich guy who has a butler, and then I think somebody mistakes him for a butler. There is boxing, anyway. I remember there's boxing.
Boxing and probably roller skates somewhere and something falling. Buster Keaton.
Let's look at Batman Shadow of the Bat number 31 mm-hmm. by Alan Grant and Brett Blevins, as promised. It's called The Battling Butler. Batman and Robin foil a robbery at a bond dealer's, but are mystified to find the owner robbing his own place, and further, not really knowing what he's doing there. This is intercut with someone dusting in Wayne Manor and making sandwiches. And yet, Batman recalls how Alfred left him during Night Quest because he couldn't stand to see him self-destructively refuse to rest. When they get back to the Batcave, the dynamic duo find sandwiches left for them and an intruder, a plump butler who doesn't recognize Tim. Batman surmises he's a version of Alfred from an alternate timeline, and this Alfred explains his master Bruce allowed him to indulge his ambition to become a detective by letting him go to a conference, but he never arrived and found himself here. While the heroes try to solve the mystery of the hypnotized bail bondsman, Alfred does a deep clean of the house, though he makes a couple of messes along the way due to his comic clumsiness. Meanwhile, Biff Bannon, ex-con, tells his gang he's made friends with a Professor Goodwin who perfected a hypnosis potion, but to make sure their crimes go off without a hitch, they should kill the Batman first. They think it's nuts to try, so Biff doses them with the potion, so they have no choice but to obey. Batman figures all of this out on his end, and he and Robin head for the dummy factory where Bannon's men are hiding out, because it's Gotham. Alfred so wants to become a detective that he secretly follows, though Batman and Robin escaped a barrage of bullets awaiting them by putting their capes on dummies and flanking the gang. They fall prey to Goodwin's hypnotic darts and are paralyzed as Bannon makes them see a monstrous city. Alfred bumbles in and is about to get shot, which is what makes Batman break the potion spell and kick Bannon and Goodwin's asses. Alfred fades from view, vowing to be the best butler he can be, and quashes his sleuthing dreams.
Oh, wow. There's a lot to unpack in here.
Okay. What do you want to unpack first?
Well, can we talk art?
We can talk art. Brett Blevins?
I really enjoyed the art, although Batman has the same face, same expression all through the the comic book.
It's a pout.
The pouty Batman all through the book. We even see Bruce Wayne's face still has the same pout. So other than that...
There's a moment where he does a like a forcing something.
Yeah, holding in a fart. Bruce's
face, but when he's trying to, you know, get rid of the potion, the domination spell or whatever.
But the art has this certain, it has a retro feel without being really retro. I don't know how to, it kind of feels like cartoons rather than.
Yeah, Brett Levins has a really cartoony style. I first encountered him on New Mutants in the 80s. I was never sure if I was a fan of it or not.
Uh-huh.
Today I like it, but it was more stylized than a lot of comics back then.
He is very stylized.
Yeah.
He has this distinct style. His I don't know if the pencils are heavy or...
It kind of works just because of the... that we are in a retro, like you say. It's kind of retro, this cartoonish feel maybe seems from another era of Batman.
Yeah, it kind of does. Still, it... Kind of doesn't. The plot seems to be from the 50s.
Okay. Yeah.
But how these criminals and how Batman, how they act is very 90s. You know, they're going to shoot the butler.
Yeah.
May he be clumsy and funny and dorky. They don't care. They're going to shoot him.
I think one of the things that makes it feel retro is the dialects. Because people speak, I mean, it's a written accent.
Yeah.
They have a written accent. Yeah. And so Alfred says, Master. And when you see the flashback to the current day Alfred, he calls him Bruce. So there's a big contrast.
Yeah.
But Master, and then the goons all have like these, they talk like this, these mugs.
Yeah, they have the Brooklyn accent.
Yeah.
You know, they're by the docks.
Yeah, they're by the docks. But it's written down, so you can... Yeah. We hear that sound.
Yeah.
And I think that also makes it kind of...
Yeah.
Like old movies.
It gives it a retro feel, but, you know, the goons, Biff, I mean, he orders a hit on the guy who's in the gang right then and there just to show off the weird potion? It's such a zany plot. You know, we have this hypnosis potion. And we can do, you know, we can make people steal their own things. And it's so stupid. But Biff is an actual killer. You know, he's going to kill Alfred. Fat Alfred. I'm going to call him Fat
Alfred.
Well,
you call him Fat Alfred. Let's address that. In Batman number 16, 1943, is the first appearance of Alfred. The Golden Age Alfred. And that's what he looked like.
Hmm.
He was also not called Alfred Pennyworth.
Really?
He was called Alfred Beagle.
Ooh.
So... and I don't know how many appearances he had as Alfred Beagle necessarily, but today or like later when they would show like the Golden Age Batman, the Earth 2 Batman, they would make sure to put the Earth 2 Alfred be Alfred Beagle. And the Pennyworth incarnation, whether it was called that or not, is because of the 1943 Batman serial that came out later that year.
Really?
And that actor... William Austin was a tall, lanky fellow with a little mustache.
So
and
he basically put the can,
right.
laid down
they
the,
went,
the
yeah, works exactly. For... They went, well, this is what the butler that people expect.
Okay.
And they started drawing him that way. And so we have an Alfred today that is the Pennyworth model.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually maybe people will be looking a lot like the Pertwee butler from Gotham or something.
Yeah.
Because he and Michael Caine. Or like somewhat a brawnier.
Yeah, yeah.
Alfred's.
Ex-military, you know, and you know.
Yeah, they're like the big men. So maybe we'll see eventually a transition to that look for Alfred. I don't know.
I think we could see that because the idea of having a Alfred who is also a trainer, it kind of is, it's interesting in Bruce Wayne's development, but also as, you know, the only person there who's the last line of defense for Wayne Manor.
Mm.
I mean, Alfred can't be this, you know, lanky, small mustache, can't do anything type guy. I mean, even the 66 television series Batman, Alfred was, you know, the battling butler. He had this mask and the glasses on top of the mask.
If he needed to get into the suit.
So, yeah.
And that was true of the comics back then as well. You know?
So, yeah.
Alfred Wood had his own Batman costume in case.
Just in case.
It's just a good secret identity.
Of course.
Fake out.
Because nobody would recognize him. But, you know. But, yeah, I kind of like that idea of you know, transitioning towards an Alfred that's, you know, I don't know, more contemporary maybe, mm-hmm. or a different style of Alfred. I really liked the idea of a, you know, bumbling.
Yeah, it's a battling butler. He could hear really the bumbling butler.
But I can see how this, how in kids' comics, this would have been funny as heck. You know, having this butler dropping coffee on the bat computer and all of a sudden.
By the way, I really need that technology. I need that Batman technology. They drop a whole coffee pot on a computer keyboard.
Yeah.
And the computer's fine.
Yeah. I don't know where. It's not an Apple product, that's for sure.
It's not a laptop, obviously.
It's not.
I mean, maybe the circuit boards aren't under the... Oh, but it just goes, oh, just a little wipe, and yeah. It's fine.
They don't even panic.
No.
It's fine. Yeah. Don't worry about it.
So maybe it's a PC, like a full... I mean, the keyboard is on the table. Well, it has to there's be. No...
Yeah, yeah. It has to be like just this, you know, low electricity, you know, like a little USB cable just... Or battery. I don't know
how that works. I don't know. Works, but Batman technology has solved this problem.
Of course it has.
You don't see him put the giant bat computer in a bowl of rice.
I mean, but I mean, can you imagine Batman having this technology and it can't be,
It's in a cave, in a damp cave.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
A cave with guano everywhere. I mean, it has to be easily wiped down.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking.
I got a couple notes on the art. Otherwise, yeah. We talked about Brent Blevins, but I think like the Goodwin character, that scientist, really looks like Commissioner Gordon, which was confusing to me.
Yeah, actually he did.
Had that mustache.
Yeah, it's very, spruce mustache, mm-hmm. kind of gray, looked like contemporary James Gordon.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a thing. The other bit is, I think there's one moment that works really weirdly, which is page 20, where it looks like when Batman and Robin get hit by darts, it really looks like it's the same dart that goes right through Batman's face and into Robin.
Yeah, yeah. They could have spaced it a little bit better. I mean, because I took a second look at that one too. I was like, ooh.
Well, who's? I mean, we're used to seeing darts hit people like in the back of the neck, in the neck,
not in the
vein. You know, you're aiming for the vein, but the cheek.
Yeah, who throws something at your cheek? Who throws a dart at a face?
And how quickly would that work? I mean, maybe that's why Batman breaks out of it so easily.
Well, yeah. I mean, who's the guy throwing the dart? A dentist? What is he trying to do? Was he aiming for the eyes? I think they were going for the eyes.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
It's the 90s. They're crippling people.
Well, Batman just came off of a crippling. A massive crippling.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what's when I...
But I mean, Batman just uses all his will to, you know, kick the gunman before he kills Alfred. I mean, it's very 50s plot, but in a 90s type...
The violence is
90s. Yeah, the violence is very 90s.
Mm-hmm. I also found it strange that they found a way or found a need to plug the book's title... On page 4, it's like they mention the shadow of the bat.
Yeah.
Because that's what got in the way of him and Alfred. Yeah.
Once again, the shadow of the bat comes in the way of my life.
So that was a... Was that like a leitmotif? Did that come back?
I don't know. It kind of felt weird, but kind of made me smile in a very... kitschy way.
Yeah, it's kitschy. I mean, we feel it whenever in a movie they say the name of the movie, or it's like, did you need to mention?
Did you need to say Deep Impact?
That was your go-to, Deep Impact?
I don't know. It just the first thing that made me laugh, actually. I don't know.
Puts on the cowl. Batman Begins. No, I mean, that doesn't happen, but it's the equivalent.
It kind of feels like that, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I'm a detective. Oh, comics. I don't know. I don't know how you do it.
What's going on? The Penguin? Catwoman? It's time for Batman to return. Was it that one? I can't remember.
Yeah, it is that one.
Okay, good.
It is that one. Okay, so what did you think of this 0 hour crossover? In other words, how does that disfit?
You know what?
Because we've had... This is our third Batman story?
Yeah, this is our third.
Yeah, we had the Batgirl one. Have we forgotten them already? We had the one where his parents are suddenly alive.
Yeah, we had two of them back to back. We had the Batgirl and the parents alive.
And then now this. And we also had the Superman issue where there were like tons of Batman from different eras. How does this one compare?
I kind of liked it because it's a you know, a secondary character, you know, Alfred. We don't really think about him that much. You know, it's kind of fun to see this old Alfred not knowing Tim. And it was kind of fun. It was a fun issue, in my opinion. What exactly, how exactly does it, you know, further the plot of Zero Hour? I have no idea.
It probably doesn't. It doesn't. It's probably one of those, really, Batman, you're going to, there's this big crisis on and this is what you're doing?
Yeah.
You're also doing the crisis thing, right? So.
Yeah. So you're going to stop a heist during this crisis? How much time do you have?
Yeah. It's part of the anomalies. This is my headcanon. Part of the anomalies is that heroes are dealing with the zero-hour crisis. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are other selves split off from them are having adventures where they're meeting other continuities, versions of other characters that they might know.
Yeah, it feels like that in this one.
If we can accept that there is a like multiple Batman in like the Superman one, then why can't there be an extra Batman foiling Biff?
Yeah.
And his plot.
Suspension of disbelief. Let's say that's what it is. Because everything's timey-wimey. We don't really have a timeline for this.
For me, it was a fun throwback to the Golden Age, which is one of the continuities that have been that's been extinguished.
And to be fair, I mean, we have four Batman titles going on during this crisis. That's a lot of Batman. And you can't all further the plot with all these Batman books. I mean, if you're going to do that, you're going to have things done before, because Batman's just that good. So you need to just put anomalies in there. Have fun with the Batman. I think they're having fun with the Batman titles.
We'll take a short promo break and come back and talk about Robin.
Ooh.
That's another Batman book.
I know, but he's not in this one.
It's true.
The Long Halloween. Hush. Dark Knight Returns. The Killing Joke.
These are all Batman stories that have been talked about and talked about countless times over the years.
They are considered classics, and in most cases, that title is fitting.
The thing is, Batman is nearly 8 decades old, and whilst those stories are worth talking about, there are plenty of other Bat comics that are being a tad overlooked.
And that's where we come in. Hi everybody, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Andrew Leyland.
Andy and I decided that it was a crime that there were so many great Batman stories out there that weren't getting their due.
To that end, we started a show, the Overlooked Dark Knight, a non-index show. The show can be found at the Fortress of Baileytude podcasting network, which is located at www.fortressofbaileytude.com, shining a bat signal on the bat stories that no one seems to remember or care about.
Because somebody has to.
We're back. We're talking about Robin number 10. But first, let's talk about Robin, Tim Drake.
Tim Drake.
Where was he in 1994? Well, they took forever to pull the trigger on Robin having his own series.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is at DC at this point that they were just like really edgy about it, despite the success of his first miniseries, which was in 1991.
Yeah.
So they did two more miniseries before finally giving Tim his own ongoing in late 1993. It would last almost 200 issues.
Yeah.
Like that Shadow of the Bat lasted like almost 100. Robin lasted almost 200.
Yeah.
In retrospect, it was a no-brainer. In late 1994, when Zero Hour happens, it's still early days for his solo adventures. He's already met spoiler, Stephanie Brown. He's gone up against her father, Clue Master. And maybe it's helped cement him as a viable solo hero that for the past few months, Azrael has worn the cowl. So certainly Azrael alienated Tim and forced him maybe to do things on his own. Now he's back with Bruce. But there's enough crime in Gotham to go around, and he deals with his fair share of cases without the Batman. But a lot of the stuff, spoiler, Robin's car, the Redbird, they were all introduced in Batman or Detective over the past couple years. So we've got a lot of toys that are Robin-related that we can have in this series, but the series didn't originate any of those things. Were you a fan? I think you were a fan of Tim Drake.
I'm a fan of all the Robins. I really enjoy the Robins. I have theories on Robins. Tim Drake is my favorite because of everything he lived through with Batman. You know, he lived through Azrael. He lived through Batman being shattered, coming back, Grayson being Batman, not wanting to be Batman. Tim is the closest Robin we've had, closest to Batman in a character sense. I mean, he's the detective.
Okay,
Ra's al Ghul calls him the detective. I mean, he doesn't do that to everybody. He calls Batman.
Because when he becomes Red Robin later,
you know,
that was an evolution of exactly that. The same way that Dick Grayson became Nightwing. And Nightwing is an evolution of the original Robin.
Yeah.
This isn't Nightwing 2.0, when he goes out on his own and has his own identity.
Exactly. And Tim was always kind of my favorite after Grayson.
Okay.
Because Grayson's is just perfect.
He's the iconic Robin.
Yeah, well, he's almost as smart as Batman. I mean, he's almost as good as a detective. He's acrobatic. He's cool. He has the great butt.
He's been Batman.
He's been a secret agent. He's been everything. He's been in a team. He's led a team. He's done everything. But Tim Drake was always kind of my favorite because he never really went the Grayson way. But he's really like a junior Batman without being junior. He has his own identity. He's smart enough to, you know, figure out who Batman was. It's easy for us. We read the comic books. We know he's Bruce Wayne. But, you know, for Tim Drake to figure all that out, I mean, that's some. I mean, Gotham PD never did it. So, you know, this kid is great. Smart, organized, maybe lacking in self-confidence at some point, but then gains this confidence within his own book. I really loved him.
Same. I mean, I read a lot of those Robin issues. I don't know how long it lasted for me, especially those early issues with Tom Grubbett art. It looked good. It was a great looking product as well. Yeah, I was totally into this new Robin in a way that I never was with the past Robins.
Really? Not even Dick Grayson?
When I really got into DC Comics, I knew Robin from the TV show. I knew Robin from Super Friends.
Okay.
But he wasn't really Robin when I think I started getting into the DC Universe proper and he was Nightwing already.
Okay.
You know?
Oh, that's fair, yeah.
Because I was just like getting an issue here and there before then. I was like a spotty reader. I started more as a Marvel reader. Started as a Tintin reader, but I mean, you know. And to me, I think the first Batman issues that I really bought either didn't have a Robin, because there was like a point where they didn't really mix and match. Because he was in the Titans or something.
Yeah.
But either him or Jason Todd, who was like this pale imitation at the beginning.
Yeah, Jason Todd kind of left a weird taste in everybody's mouth.
It just didn't really work, right?
Just didn't jive.
So, like, I was there for Death in the Family. I was there for Jason's death. I have those issues.
Who wasn't?
But yeah, so it wasn't really... It's like Batman was... Robin was a retro thing. And when I really got into Batman was when we had Alan Grant, Norm Breyfogle, and these kinds of people working on Detective and Batman.
Okay.
So just now, just around this time, you know, Shadow of the Bat is on, Legends of the Dark Knight. I was reading all four Batman books.
Oh, wow.
So this is my Robin.
And then the movie came out and you just went nuts.
Which one? Well, that was Batman. 89, so...
And this is when?
94.
94, okay, yeah, I know.
So
Val Kilmer was almost about to ruin everything.
Yeah, I think so. Huh?
Something like that.
But 94, I guess we're getting the Batman animated series. Where, you know.
Well, everything was Batman back then. So.
Yeah. So this Robin, I thought was cool. I've always liked him. I followed him to the Red Robin series in later days when I started reading comics again. So I would say, yes, this is my Robin.
Yeah, and you know he's a good Robin because in the animated series, we went from Dick Grayson to Tim Drake. We never saw Jason Todd. Mm-hmm.
And the Dick Grayson we had was dressed like Tim Drake.
Yeah, he had pants.
He was like the older, already old, and he had the look, the colors of Tim Drake. And then, that season where...
Yeah,
they kind of changed the drawings, and we've got a Nightwing, and we've got...
Yeah, and we have this kid who's smart, not as athletic, but smarter, combat-wise, pretty darn good. I mean, these two Robins are, I think, iconic, are great. Jason Todd was a bad Robin, but a great Red Hood. This evolution from being a bad Robin, and they kind of dug that, and they said, you know what, we're going to make him a bad Robin. And he was horrible. Nobody liked him. And this is going to be his motivation for being the Red Hood. And that worked. Because Red Hood rocks. I mean, he's horrible, but he rocks. And Damian's cool, too. I mean, I like the kid.
Yeah.
He's the assassin, you know.
Yeah, he's neat. I mean, it's a cool concept.
It's a cool concept, but, you know. I'm not going to get into my theories on how the Robins of the time kind of counterbalance the Batman of the time.
Okay.
Where, you know, we had punchy Batman in the 90s, so we have a Detective Robin in the 90s. And that kind of counterbalances what Batman is supposed to be. You know, we have fun Robin in the 50s. Everything was fun in the 50s, but, you know, let's say 70s, Robin was funner than Batman, who was starting to be brooding. You know, we have this detective all of a sudden, Batman, and we have a punchy Robin.
How do you, the Damian versus Batman in the modern era? Or is it Damian with the, who was first paired up with the Dick Grayson Batman?
Actually, no, I think Damian kind of counteracts Batman also, because he's just pure rage. You know, he just wants to, he's an assassin, he wants to kill people, where Batman has this code and has contained the rage. It's more on an emotional level with Damian, but I still think he counterbalances all of a sudden. He just makes it taste good. Robin just makes Batman taste good.
That's cooking tips. Robin number 10, it's by Chuck Dixon, Tom Grummett, and Ray Kreising. It's called Two Birds, One Stone. Robin, Tim Drake, is chasing after Chet the Weasel Grimes, a thief and slippery escape artist who has stolen the Van Meer Opal from a museum. He's questioning known associates who decide to attack him, and he gets help from a surprising quarter, a young Dick Grayson, the original Robin, who comes to the rescue. They prove their credentials to one another, and the chase is back on as Robin, monitoring police radio, hears of cop cars chasing Grimes on the highway. He escapes the police, but the Robins are closer to his destination, the Gotham Aquarium, and they head him off at the pass. Inside the aquarium, the Weasel shoots at them but misses, breaking the glass and releasing shark-filled waters at the Boy Wonders. Dick easily escapes with his acrobatics, while Tim takes a more direct route with a bat line that puts him in the way of a killer whale. They make it out and see Grimes climbing a tree in the Amazon section. He falls into the tank below, and when the Robins go down one level, only his skeleton remains, ravaged by piranha. They call the cops, and the CSI can't be sure it's really Grimes. Something has also been nagging at Tim, because the Weasel is too slick an operator to have allowed himself to get into a police chase to a dead end like the aquarium and so forth. Something Harvey Bullock says about jelly donuts finally makes it click for Tim, and the Robins double back to find Grimes in a closet, having staged his own death as one last escape. He has the opal on him, but before he can be delivered to the GCPD, everything goes white and reality is erased. Presumably. I don't know. Is he caught?
We don't know.
When reality resets, what happens to the Weasel?
The Weasel, I don't know, but that's that's what we're going to find out.
Okay. So, what did you think of this issue?
Oh, I loved it. I actually really dug this. Because we really see, and even Dick Grayson is well written in this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's classic Dick Grayson, and Tim Drake is the detective, and he basically acts like Batman in a colorful suit. The way he interacts with Grayson at the beginning where they meet up, how Grayson just says, yeah, you know what, we have a skeleton. Let's wrap this up. It's done. And then Tim goes, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. And these two work together. I just love it.
Yeah, I think it shows how similar they are.
Yeah.
Because they're thinking as a unit. They both have imposter syndrome. Yeah. Like that. But Tim is impressed that the even younger Robin still speaks with authority and confidence. And there's something there about Dick Grayson himself. And no matter what age he is, he was on top of it. He was a pro. He was Robin at 12.
Exactly.
And Tim started later. And so at this point, even though he's younger than Tim, he's still a veteran.
Yeah.
You know, he still has a lot of experience. I think there's like Tim's bias in there that he looks up to Dick Grayson. The current date, Dick Grayson. So here he's like, oh my God, this is the person I am modeling my career on. And today he's Nightwing, but this is Robin. This is the ideal that I am striving for.
Yeah.
I think he's impressed and he admires him, and that colors his perception, and we're seeing the story through his eyes.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, it's a great story. I think after this issue, I wouldn't be surprised that Tim Drake gets better at being Robin because of this encounter. I think it's a great issue.
Yeah.
Putting a past Robin with new Robin, this is one of the greatest of these types of stories I've seen.
Up to now, this is one of the better...
Oh, yeah. And they talk about anomalies, et cetera, but this really actually feels within the crisis. The whiteout.
With the whiteout, that's
at
true.
At the end, that's also very nice. But at the end, spoiler alert, Tim disappears also.
Well,
they all disappear, yeah.
reality, the aquarium. Will it be rebuilt? Will Gotham not have an aquarium? And it also showcases their differences because, one is a techie, the other one's more of an acrobat. They're both good detectives, but they seem to have different intuitions. So it's fun to see that they're complementary. They're not just...
Oh, yeah.
They're not just the same. You see the differences, and yet they still work well together. And I like that aquarium setting for fights, because you've got the classic bit where the water breaks and the man-eaters come out. You've got the killer whale. In Tim Drake's thoughts, oh, good thing killer whales aren't known to eat people. but still.
Yeah.
You kind of get nose bumped by a killer whale.
Yeah.
Which is gonna be dangerous for your undies.
Well, yeah. But it's such a Batman-y thing to do, to think, to have this knowledge of these, of these blackfish, of these...
I almost feel like Dick should have been the sort of
expert.
Because we've got the killer whale, but later we've got like the piranha.
Yeah.
The big clue is that these kinds of piranha don't eat people.
Yeah.
Right? The black piranha don't eat people. And so it doesn't make sense that the weasel might have been eaten. But you got to know, really specific piranha facts. I mean, I can only imagine, Batman and Robin playing with safari cards. Okay, this one.
Yeah. Well,
this one.
Kind of brings you back.
Hornet toads. Oh, they shoot blood out of their eyes when they're scared. Okay. Black piranha. They don't eat people. Okay. Just flashcards.
It really feels like they've been in one of the episodes from Batman 66.
But that's why I thought this should have been we need for Tim to solve this. It's his book.
Yeah.
We need him to solve it. But at the same time, I feel like it should have been the Dick Grayson one who is...
Yeah.
Is would be strong on these odd trivia as a wink to Batman 66. And then maybe Tim could have gone, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Just the discipline on this guy. But instead, I believe that Tim is a trivia master. He's always on the internet. It's, he's a kid of the 90s.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I felt like that was a Dick moment.
Oh, this is certainly a, in all good sense of the word, a Dick move.
An interesting bit is with Superboy, we found out that he liked chick grunge.
Yeah.
Here there's a reference, suggestion that Robin likes speed metal.
I did not catch that.
Because he's thinking when the sharks are attacking. He, in his thought captions, he's saying something about, why am I, suddenly all I can think about is the Jaws theme, a speed metal cover of the Jaws theme.
Oh my God, yeah.
So, for your mind to go there, that's got to be your music.
It has to be your music. In dire circumstances, it has to be your music. Why would you think that? Oh my God.
So, Tim Drake, speed metal.
Speed metal.
We're collecting these. these references to superhero musical... preferences.
In 94, what was the big speed metal bands?
Well, he's a teenager, so he'd probably not necessarily listen to the stuff that's out currently. He would like older stuff. Just when I was in high school, everybody was listening to Led Zeppelin, which was a 70s band.
Yeah.
So, in the 90s...
94? In 94?
Well, but 94, I don't know, but not so long before, Megadeth was a thing.
Yeah.
I think my friends who played guitar when I was in college in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Like Megadeth. That's speed metal. I'm not
really versed.
I'm not a big speed
metal verse.
I'm not a speed freak. But
I'm sure somebody has listened to a lot of speed metal.
I think Megadeth would be the prime example, mainstream example of speed metal.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine.
So Robin is... has
metalhead. Hey, that works.
I mean, it's that or what? Nirvana? Or, is he grunge like Superboy?
Probably.
He's a hacker.
See, that's where...
Earbuds, speed metal.
Yeah, he's probably speed metal. Anything with a quick drum. I mean, speed metal, maybe punk, quick songs.
I think Jason was a punk.
You think? I think he was a poser. I think he said he liked punk.
Jason would have liked punk, not the real, not good punk, just the pop punk. And then maybe whatever Dick. I mean, if this is the time scale where these people are this age in 94.
Dick probably listened to Pat Boone and stuff
Well, originally, but I think If it's 94, yeah, whatever their ages are, you know, Dick was listening to like Duran Duran.
Dick was probably stuck in the 80s.
Yeah.
He was listening to Duran Duran at the end of their, you know, mm-hmm, yeah. He yeah, was yeah, listening to
Bangles.
You know what? I think Dick probably listened to electro music. Mm. You know, he probably liked the club scene because, you know, he has the moves.
It's true.
And
that's
the
true. That's
and
true.
The tight outfit.
But speed metal for Tim. So that was a fun bit to get. Did you get the... It took me a while. I had to reread three times the section where the clue, the thing that clues Tim onto the fact that Black Piranha.
It's a thing with the donuts, yeah, or but I don't get it.
Okay, so it's basically, and I think this is very, very slim, and again, it's a Batman 66.
Okay.
Making it like, jumping to conclusions.
Because it has something to do with jelly donuts and not eating jelly donuts.
Well, it's the not eating, what's his name, Bullock.
Yeah.
Harvey Bullock is offered jelly donuts. He says, you know I don't eat jelly donuts. Black Piranha don't eat people. That's the leap. No, yeah, that's the leap. Yeah, so at first I was like, what is this? What does the solution have anything to do with jelly or donuts? Or so I couldn't like place the part of the sentence that was the clue until I read it like a couple of times. So to me, that was like the weakest element probably.
Yeah, it's a leap. But yeah, I didn't get it.
The other thing I had in my notes is the Novik off-ramp. They name off-ramps? Okay. This off-ramp is named the Novik off-ramp. And of course, it's a reference to the Batman artist Irv Novik, who I do believe drew that issue of Invasion that we covered years ago.
Really now?
Yeah. And we saw a lot of these sort of name droppings in Superboy and in other books. So I think DC was leaning hard on this kind of tribute. Just paying tribute instead of paying money. Let's pay tribute to our former creators. I'm sort of realizing, like reading them as a batch, that this is really the legacy era, where a lot of heroes are legacy heroes that are replacing older heroes. But we're also paying tribute to that legacy of artists.
Yeah.
So though they're written and drawn by people, we're going to do a lot of these buildings and streets that are named after the people that have gone before. So I don't know if that was like a concerted effort or somebody started doing it and they all started doing
it. Well, we started seeing that in the TV series. I mean, the Flash TV series.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was also at that era.
Yeah, and they had the streets of Gardner and Fox, mm-hmm, I believe, or they had this Gardner Fox building or something like that.
Right,
or
the original Flash.
Yeah. And I mean, they had a lot of these things going on, so I think that
Batman 89, the movie, also has streets.
I think so.
That,
but I
streets are just like unimportant characters have names that are like former creators. So I don't know. There was something in the air.
Yeah, there's something.
And maybe they've been doing this for decades before then. But I feel like right now, in 94, right now being 94, we're getting a lot of that at the same time that characters are legacy.
Yeah.
So.
There's a lot of legacy dust everywhere.
So this one, you know what, could have a claim to be the best Zero Hour crossover issue that we've seen.
Oh, yeah. It's my favorite. Right now, it's my favorite.
I think the same. I think this one stands up as, it's a good little mystery.
Yeah.
And the characters are really cool and the art is really great.
Yeah.
So.
Loved it. I mean, I can't imagine anything in the future being better than this.
Oh, well, I don't disagree. I'm not saying, oh, no way. No, maybe we hit the big.
Well, I really enjoyed it.
Crescendo at episode 7. It's all down here from here.
You know, of course, I'm a Robin fan. Mm. I really enjoy Robin, all the Robins. And this kind of, I really dug it because, you know, both characters were great, well written. The mystery was fun. It's not a major thing. I really enjoyed it.
We'll take a short break. And when we return, your feedback on our previous episode.
We have feedback?
In 2011, the Irredeemable Shag and Aqua Rob Kelly teamed up to create the Fire and Water podcast. In 2016, they teamed up with Ryan Daly, The Franklins, and Siskoid to form the Fire and Water Podcast Network. A network built on teaming up needs a show about team-ups.
Marvel Team-Up.
Yes.
The Brave and the Bold?
You know it.
Marvel 2-in-1.
It's clobbering time.
DC Comics presents.
Of course.
Supervillain team up?
Good idea.
Youngblood X-Force?
Technically.
FW Team Up, only from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
We're back. Excerpts from your comments.
Ooh.
On our coverage of Superman number 93 and Dark Stars number 24.
Yeah, that's right. We read Dark Stars.
We did.
And did you see Dark Stars are kind of back?
Are they?
I saw something about Dark Stars lately, so I don't know. I don't know Dark Stars, but I have my head in old books right now.
Well, let's start with Captain Entropy. You had the information we were missing about Lara's surname. So Superman's mom, her last name is Lorvan.
Lorvan.
Lorvan. We also have David Ace Gutierrez says, "Oh, Dark Stars. I think it was known more for the then Jim Lee clone Travis Charest's artwork more than anything else. I never dipped my toe into that series despite my love of Donna Troy and John Stewart. I think the problem with having so many Supes and Bats titles going on at the same time is the diminishing returns on all the crossover related stories. Take these tie-ins or Armageddon 2000, DC 1 million, or the Zero issues. Some strong stories, most were dull as balls, and some stinkers. Lots of non-starter filler nonsense." From Rob Kelly, Bastiou said, "David S. Gutierrez doesn't understand my life." Rob says, "I knew if I listened to this show long enough, something said on it would really connect with me."
I smell rivals?
They're good friends, actually. We asked Dan S. to clarify what Neil Gaiman's work on the Spectre was, that he meant last time. And it was indeed that one appearance in the Books of Magic. He says, "I always liked Gaiman's gift for characterization and thought he brought some nuance to the Spectre. I always dug the gravitas Gaiman could bring." So just like that one issue was really impactful for him. Martin Gray says, "I really enjoyed the Superman issue. I'm a sucker for Kent parental anxiety. It's totally Silver Age. Jor-El and Lara were forever turning up to claim their kid. I always hated the Burn Krypton folks' outfits. They look like refugees from Alice in Wonderland playing card people." Michael Bailey says, "Well, first, insert 20-page story about how much I love this era of Superman." And then says, "Dan Jurgens never had a bad inker for an extended run during his time on Superman, from Art Tiber to Brett Breeding to Joseph Rubinstein to Norm Rapmund. It was all good. They all had subtle differences, but I liked all of them in different ways. During this post-return era, Jurgens really opened up the page designs, and it was all gold. This issue may have looked a little looser, but I still enjoyed it. Between certain recent realizations and your commentary, I came to the conclusion that while I will usually find something to like about any iteration of Superman, this one will always be my favorite. Clark thinking of himself as human, Kryptonian second, will always work better for me. I don't begrudge anyone their personal taste, but if I'm going to read an extended run of the character, I have to connect with him in some way, and this version just does it for me. And despite our mutual love of Highlander and the movie Cuffs, David Ace Gutierrez is dead wrong about Superman's crossover issues being dull." As balls. "With the exception of the Eclipso annuals, I sometimes like the crossover issues better than the main series. I hope he and I can still be friends." Never. Wardhill Terry asks, "Why would any version of Jor-El go to the Kent home? Let's go to Earth and surprise grown-up Cal, who doesn't know us. Where will we find him? Well, we could send him a message to meet us, or we could go to his workplace or to where he lives. But my sun detector beam can only find where my son was 20 years ago. Must be this time out of joint business." But in this case, well, I wish I could say it's because that's where the capsule is.
Well, probably.
But it's not. The capsule was in the Fortress of Solitude at this point.
Oh, my.
So yeah, they should have gone to the South Pole.
Why? South Pole?
That post-crisis of South Pole.
Okay. And they have statues in there of them.
Of themselves.
I mean,
why not go see that?
Yeah.
I mean, there's more to see than on the farm. Tim Price says, "Dark Stars was a thing that I heard about, bought two issues of, and that was that. Donna joining was mildly intriguing, but only because I was still buying Titans and would continue for quite a while longer. I wonder whose idea it was. Friedman, to give the story a twist with a new lead? Wolfman, to get Donna powers again so she could rejoin the Titans properly after being non-powered since the Total Chaos story? Ooh, what if the story had featured Donna meeting the pre-crisis Diana? Is it bad that the suggestions you guys give sound far more compelling than the story that was done? Yes, it is."
Well, yeah, that's what we thought also.
Yeah.
Why would two dumbasses giving out ideas would be better than this comic?
Where were we?
Where were we in the 90s university?
Yeah. Let's see. I've got some. Actually, I've got some iTunes reviews.
Really now?
They're more general, but they're worth reading.
Well, certainly. Of course, yeah.
They're all 5 stars.
thank you.
Yeah. First, we got RL Sharp 77 says, "Bow down to the kings of the event crossover," and that's just the title of the review.
Wow.
The review itself is enough said.
Wow.
So the title is the review. Count Druncula entitles his "Better Than Zero." a lot of things are better than zero. It says, okay, I may be biased because I like the hosts, but I'm going to say it here. Despite having not listened to the show yet as of the writing of the review, I feel confident declaring that this that the best Fire and Water Podcast Network show dedicated to the DC Comics event 0 hour ever. That this is the best Fire and Water Podcast Network show dedicated to the DC Comics
ever. That is the weirdest review ever.
Subscribe to this show and give it a listen. And then Mike Z33 says, 0 hour is here. Once the Invasion podcast was over, I heard that this was next in line. It gave me new books to look for while diving in the cheap bins. Lots of material to cover, and I'll be reading along. Cheers.
It's fun to go in the cheap bins. I've been dabbling
in
the
cheap bins.
Yeah, I've been cheap binning for a couple, and it's great. You find all kinds of stuff in there.
I don't like the cheap bins anymore because there's like too much 90s stuff.
Oh, there's a lot of 90s
so stuff. Either I already have it or I dismissed it at the time for good reason. But when I was a kid, you bought off the stands and it was what it was.
Yeah.
But there was like a flea market.
Okay.
And sometimes you go there and there was like 3 comics or something. You bought all the comics you could and there was like only like 3 or 4.
Yeah.
At this place. It's Edmonton, New Brunswick. It's not a big place.
Yeah.
Either that or a friend, colleague at school would bring in comics and I would like trade. Like, I don't like this run of World's Finest or something. And then he'd give me, and very often they were like older comics. In both these cases, like 70s comics, kind of late 70s. And those were magical to me.
Well, yeah.
Those felt like weird artifacts. They had like a different smell and they were like different sizes. It's almost, it's like, what is this giant size Fantastic Four? Why can't I get that kind of, it's all ripped up and it's got like the cover's partial and I don't care. It's magical.
How can you have 84 pages in one comic?
They're more mysterious because you only get like one issue of a run in the middle of a year sometime.
Yeah.
And so that's the feeling of the bargain bin.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty much what I look for when I go cheap binning. It's just fun to... I don't really look for anything in particular. I just go diving in there. And when I see something I really like, or even if it's just a cover... I mean, it's a dollar bin. I don't care. I'm going to grab a cover I really like or something and read the comic. And I'm all of a sudden just amazed at what I find. So it's really fun.
Before we go, we have to mention that the Fire and Water Podcast Network now has a Patreon page.
Ooh, yeah.
It's been a while now. So if you like our content, please think about making a one-time or monthly donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Get on that zero list. I don't know what it means yet, but if you listen to my other shows, there's a little extra bonus. It's not just saying your name on air. You know, you got a little something.
There's some zing in there.
It's at patreon.com/FW podcasts. A reminder that you can leave us comments at the fireandwaterpodcast.com website. Of course, you can also follow Fire and Water's Facebook page or on Twitter. The account is FW Podcast. You can also now find the podcast on Spotify.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's how you prefer your podcast delivered. Just search for 0 hour strikes. And in fact, I think most of the Fire and Water shows are now available on that platform.
Yeah, that was quite easy. You're on there already. You know what? I'm going to make it easy for you. Okay, Google, play Fire and Water Podcast Network podcasts. There you go.
Arguably, people already know where to find the podcast because they're listening to one. Arguably. But if somehow this is reaching you like a butler from the golden age. You don't know how, but there's a time anomaly that is sending. You're just listening to your true crime podcast.
Yeah.
And suddenly.
All of a sudden, you have this.
And you love it. Well, there's a strange reality where you're happy that this happened.
In a strange reality where the bargain bin is these podcasts.
Next time on 0 Hour Strikes, Hawkman 9-13.
Mm-hmm.